From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
School reopening becomes a political brawl, plus the latest at the courthouse in Portland, Oregon. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. Sitting in today for Paul Jagot, we are joined by my colleagues today, Bill McGurn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
And one of our editorial board members, Alicia Finley. Hello, Alicia.
Hi, Kyle.
So with the fall school year fast approaching, many parents still aren't sure what it might look like for them. Last week, the American Federation of Teachers, a teachers union with about 1.7 million members, issued a resolution essentially saying that if local chapters want to strike over school reopening plans, they have the blessing of the national leadership. Here's a quote from the AFT's leader, Randy Weingarten. She says, quote, "If authorities don't protect the safety and health of those we represent and those we serve, as our executive council voted last week, nothing is off the table," unquote. So, Bill, what do you make of this turn?
Well, I think what it's bringing out is that, again, the teachers' unions don't have the best interest of the students in deciding this. They have a whole list of demands. You know, in LA, I think the demands for reopening included defunding the police. In Chicago, I think it includes passing a state income tax. Look, they claim this is all about health, but the CDC has said that actually getting kids back in the classroom for in-person learning is a public health measure itself, given the other risks that children have when they're not in school learning. And the CDC further went on to say that the ones who are harmed most by not being in the classroom are low-income and minority groups that can't afford, say, tutoring or other extras that more wealthy parents want. I just see this as a political grab. You know, never let an opportunity go to waste. And it also puts a pressure on their competitors because, you know, one of the problems is the public schools get funded and paid even if they're not in school. Private and religious schools don't have that luxury. They need tuition and donations to keep going. And the Cato Institute estimates that more than 100 private and religious schools have closed permanently, at least partially due to COVID. So, in some ways, this is a cynical attempt by the teachers union to squeeze some of their competitors. So the bottom line is, not only do they not want to open, it's important for them to keep other people from opening too, lest they be embarrassed by other schools showing it can be done.
A lot of points there, Bill, but to start with the health issue specifically, Alicia, I mean, you've looked at some of the data, some of the scientific studies. What do we really know about kids and COVID-19 at this point, and specifically whether and how likely they are to get the virus and how likely they are to spread it to others?
So what appears right now is that they're probably just as likely as adults to get the virus. But younger kids so far, probably those under age 10, so far seem less infectious, that they are less likely to spread it or transmit it, while teenagers appear just to be equally as infectious as adults. And some of this is going off of based off of a couple of studies in France that were done, retrospective studies from when schools were still open in February and the virus was circulated, and they tested everyone for antibodies in high schools and lower grades. And they found, even though there were three kids who had been infected in lower grades, it had not circulated widely among school students at the school or the staff. But that had not been the case in the high school, that it was somewhat over 40% of students and their parents and teachers had gotten the virus. But of course, most of them didn't even know it. They were large numbers of asymptomatic. And we do know that young kids and teenagers are very unlikely to get severely ill. I think there have been only about 36 deaths among kids under 14 so far. California, I think, recorded just this last week its first death among someone under 19. So their kids are much more at risk of dying, flu, pneumonia, drowning, some other accidental death, actually even suicide. Suicides are much higher even among young kids than COVID deaths so far. So the real concern right now is about kids bringing it home possibly and infecting their parents and potentially teachers, though there are measures, risk mitigation measures that, you know, the CDC has outlined, the Academy of Pediatrics has outlined that do appear to work. We've seen this in Detroit. Detroit had a summer school program where they implemented these measures and they didn't really have any infections.
And the risk of reopening in person, Bill, the CDC statement, it seems to suggest, has to be weighed against the learning losses too. I mean, that's part of the overall picture. Speaking from experience, 20 pre-K kids on a Zoom call, I would not say is highly educational, but there's some research and reporting on this that suggests that the distance learning, the internet education, just has not worked all that well.
Well, one reason, in fairness, is I think that it was sprung on people. You know, some school systems, especially at the university level, have been doing distance learning and probably have, you know, learned a few things from it. But, you know, this year, we put so many teachers on it and so many kids on it that didn't have experience before. So there were bound to be a lot of glitches. But I think, again, even the CDC, you know, makes clear they're just not equal generally to having an in-person experience, you know, with a teacher right there. And, you know, what's interesting is that in some of its objections, the teachers' unions around the country, they're not only objecting to in-person learning in the classroom, they don't want to be tied to being online, being available during the Zoom instructions, right? They more distant thing. My guess is there's a whole spectrum of achievement and efficacy online, but we're probably far from it. And I think, again, the CDC is right that the people that are going to suffer the most harm from this in terms of their learning are people that can't afford options. I mean, do we know that everyone has access to Wi-Fi, for example, or a computer? There are a lot of question marks in there. And it looks like if we continue along this path, a lot of children are going to be left behind.
Well, and that's part of the issue. I mean, when there was the shift to online education, there was an argument to be made that not everyone had access to the same resources. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Los Angeles Teachers Union was arguing that students who get a D grade should not be mandated summer school because there's a fairness issue here. And so, for example, there's a report, I think in June, from researchers at the University of Washington looking at 477 school districts and saying that only 27% of these districts required teachers to track whether students were basically online. Homework counted toward final grades in only 42% of them. The Philadelphia Inquirer said that the school district there, only 61% of students were showing up online on an average day. I mean, those are real problems, Alicia.
Right. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see dropout rates increase as a result among high school students. But the problem really is, especially in the lower grades here, where the virtual instruction just doesn't work. I mean, I've heard stories about kindergartners or first graders who have to do coloring sheets and then scan them in. The other issue with virtual learning is screen time. A lot of screen time is not good for children's brain development. That's found it increases behavioral problems, can contribute to ADHD, and moreover, kids need the peer-to-peer interaction and being in school with teachers. It actually helps modulate depression, anxiety, and those kinds of mental illnesses that you're actually starting to see now crop up. So this is not just an education issue, it's a mental health issue, and actually can is to some extent a physical health issue, because this is one thing that hasn't gotten enough attention, needs to, is that being in a stressful home environment actually adversely affects children's immunity, both as children and as they become adults. I mean, they've done studies that found that children who are in stressful home environments actually develop fewer antibodies in response to flu vaccines. So this is one other reason why the Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that students be physically present in schools.
Hang tight, we'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. And then, Bill, another point to make is it seems difficult sometimes, at least to me, to disentangle what exactly is being demanded by teachers' unions and groups like that. For, I mean, so like the Republican the Republican proposal for the Phase 5 coronavirus relief legislation has about $100 billion for schools in that. There's some arguments from Democrats that it should be higher than that. There's an Associated Press story that they talked to a vice president of Chicago's teachers union, and the AP story says, quotes that, or paraphrases that person to say that, quote, any safety strike would include broader demands to support frontline workers, to provide broadband access to every student, to ensure universal health care. And so it's not always clear to me, Bill, what exactly they want that's specifically tied to the issue of lowering the risk of transmission of the virus.
Right. I think what you're saying is that their demands are not really about health. They're fighting reopening. And one of the interesting things is, I believe one of the bones of contention in the stimulus package is that Republicans want to send funds to help schools reopen, and the Democrats don't. I mean, because the Democrats would rather keep the economy shut down and so forth. You know, maybe it's because they think that would hurt Trump in November. But that's one of the big fights going on. And I think, again, what this crisis is showing, clearly the teachers' union attitude is, you know, never let a crisis go to waste. But I think it's illuminating that they don't have the interest of the students first and foremost. Again, go back to the CDC. It's not saying just open willy-nilly. It's saying here are steps you can take to mitigate things. And the teachers' unions are pretending that it can't be done, that no one should be allowed to do it and so forth. And I think some parents are switching their kids because of this. You know, Alicia mentioned the other two demands that they're making in many cases: do away with student evaluations tests and do away with teachers' evaluations. Isn't that convenient? If we're not going to measure whether the teachers are teaching or the students are learning. You know, Alicia mentioned, you know, if you get a D, they don't want to mandate summer school. Kyle, I can tell you, if you and I, if our child got a D, we would want the further instruction, right? I mean, this is not helping the kids in any way. It's a political movement, and the kids are being sacrificed.
And some of the so some schools have said that they're reopening virtually this fall. Some are also doing sort of hybrid plans, Alicia, where, you know, every other day maybe. So one group of students, the A group, will come in on Monday, Wednesday. The B group will come in on Tuesday, Thursday. They'll switch off on Friday, and half the kids will be in the classroom at one time. Half the kids will be remote. And I sort of understand the idea there is to increase the distance between people to lower the capacity of the school. But at the same time, it seems strange to me because if you are going, if you're switching off every other day, then you're still being exposed to the same number of people. I mean, if it was, if we're switching off by weeks, for 2 weeks the A group will go in, and then for 2 weeks the B group will go in. That I could sort of make sense of.
Right. This doesn't actually make sense. You're right about that. I think the Providence superintendent or school leader, Angelante Infante Green, has said as much too. It's either safe to open schools or it's not, if you're thinking about this from a public health perspective. And this is just creates logistical difficulties. It really reduces the benefits, I mean, at least to parents who now have to juggle these schedules. And I mean, I guess in some cases, you know, some physical learning is better than none, but this doesn't seem to be among the interventions that would actually help. I mean, it makes much more sense to keep kids and, you know, keep kids in certain, I guess, not pods, but keep them in the same groups throughout the day so they're not interacting with, you know, different groups, you know, in middle schools and high schools. They often have different classes with different students, you know, electives. So keeping kids in the same group could help, you know, at least better contain any kind of outbreak you might have. But this doesn't, what you're suggesting does not make sense.
And I can understand how if you are deemed an essential worker and you're required to be at your job physically present, I can understand how, you know, this might rub you the wrong way. So there's an interesting article in The Atlantic online written by an intensive care nurse in New York City, and her husband is a school teacher. And the headline of the piece is, "I'm a nurse in New York. Teachers should do their jobs just like I did. Schools are essential to the functioning of our society, and it makes teachers essential workers." And I can understand how if you're a nurse, an intensive care nurse, or even if you're an essential worker at a grocery store, and you've been trying to juggle this childcare while the schools have been closed, I can understand how you would be a little bit piqued by this argument that, well, let's just do everything virtually through December.
Yeah, aren't teachers supposed to be like public servants? You know, they're that, you know, below sort of above sort of crass concerns and so forth. I think the nurse has a very good argument. And as you say, I think that applies to all these other people that are working, truck drivers, people at the grocery store stocking shelves. There's a whole slew of people that are working and presumably in more dangerous positions than those of us who stay home. And it's, again, with the CDC weighing in, it's hard to see the justification for that. Look, I think it reflects two different philosophies. One philosophy is let's shut down and keep inside until there's a vaccine, which may be a long time off. And the other side is let's manage the risks. Let's identify the risks and try to manage them in the best way we know how to get as many people back to functioning normally. And I think that's what we should be doing to the schools. And I also think instead of trying to make sure others can't close, we should see what people do, how they adapt within the guidelines, learn the best practices, you know, what works in what places. And we should be rooting for everyone to succeed. And that does not seem to be the case to me.
And I'm starting to wonder, Alicia, if this may create some permanent changes in the K-12 school landscape. I mean, so there seems to be, there's reportedly some increased interest in parents switching to private schools, which are non-unionized generally. And since parents are paying out of pocket for those private schools, in addition to paying property taxes for the public schools, the private schools have a way bigger incentive to give parents what they want or what they need if they can figure out a way to do it safely. Then you also hear about people who have tried this homeschooling a little bit and figured out that maybe that'll work for them, or they're setting up these pods, for lack of a better term, with a small group of parents, and they're going to share the burden of that homeschooling. And I wonder, you know, if in 5 years or 10 years, we might look back at this moment and see a real change for a big chunk of parents about how they approach schooling their kids.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, in many states, you've already, you know, homeschooling has been on the rise. And actually, these pods predate the pandemic. There were a lot of parents who were in the Bay Area, California's Bay Area. This was already occurring. I do think part one impediment to the private schools is they do charge tuition, so many middle school families can't afford that. But I do also think that many families are upset about how the direction that some public schools are headed on, also on their curriculum, in terms of now, you know, mandating, at least in California, you know, transgendered kind of studies as early as elementary school. And, you know, I think they're going to learn, or some parents are going to find that they don't actually need to have their kids in public schools.
All right. And then switching gears a little bit, we talked last week about the rioting at the courthouse in Portland, Oregon, which appears, at least for now, to have calmed some. And Bill, your column this week is under the headline, Trump Wins in Portland. So what has happened there? What's the update? And what's your argument?
Well, my argument is that I wouldn't say I've been skeptical about federal intervention, but I think you have to be very careful. You know, upholding the law is primarily a local responsibility. So I'm skeptical about the ability of the federal government to take over these things. Sometimes President Trump's rhetoric implies that he wants to go in and take over everything, which I think is a recipe for disaster. Look how hard it was to secure that courthouse. But if you separate the president's rhetoric from the reality, what he's actually done, in Portland, he sent in federal law enforcement, and of course, the attacks just increased. But finally, the governor and the mayor agreed to deploy state troopers and local police to protect the courthouse. So the courthouse was protected. I mean, that's firmly within a president's responsibility to protect federal property. And I think now we have the best of all worlds. The locals have stepped up to their jobs. And that's what I think the measure of success should be, more modest. It's because, look, if it's left to the federal government, what does that mean? Like, you can't really win. You can't station or you could do it, but I'm not sure it would count as a victory. You could station, you know, a row six people thick all the way around the courthouse indefinitely, but I don't think that's really securing it. This is a better left to locals. The real problem is locals were not doing their jobs. They were egging the protesters on. And so I think the president kind of forced them into some accountability there. By the way, the federal law enforcement officers are still in Portland. They're not around the courthouse on the outside, but they're waiting to see when it's truly safe, you know, for the courthouse before they leave.
But that's why, Bill, you say that it's a victory for Trump, because everyone here is claiming a win. I mean, the mayor of Portland, right. The governor of Oregon are all saying that Trump has taken his troops out and we've won the fight here. But that's why you're saying that that he's gotten what he's wanted.
If the goal is to protect the federal courthouse and restore order, the best way to restore order is to get people who have the chief responsibility for maintaining it to do their jobs. They weren't doing their jobs. Remember, there was a lot of violence around the courthouse before Trump sent in the federal law enforcement officers. In fact, that's why he did it. So we finally have both the state and the locals meeting their responsibilities. And a lot of these, and it's not just in Portland, a lot of the reason for the violence that we're seeing in all these cities is basically local mayors, mostly progressive and Democrat, have abdicated their responsibility to take on criminal activity.
So Portland has calmed a little bit, but there's still a lot of unrest. There was protest outside the home of Seattle's police chief, Carmen Best. And violent crime is up in a lot of places. We talked about Minneapolis maybe last week, I think. And Alicia, how much of this do you think is a result of anger at the police, maybe police pullback? In some cases, they've, you know, New York disbanded a plainclothes unit. And how much do you think is a function of the lockdowns, people stir crazy, people on furlough, they don't have to be at their job the next day?
So I think it's a confluence of things. It's politicians encouraging an environment of basically chaos, and police definitely pulling back. I think in New York and some other places, you've had not only bail laws, where basically you have an elimination of bail for nonviolent crimes and even some violent crimes that aren't considered violent, like carrying a gun or in a place, a sensitive place. You've also had thousands of offenders, criminals let out of jail within during the pandemic to for ostensibly to protect their prison populations. But, you know, police chiefs around the country have been warning that this is increasing, leading to an increase in crime. And you saw that, you know, even before the summer, you start seeing that uptick in March and April. And then you just have the pressure on the police not to enforce basic quality, you know, what's known as quality of life crimes, you know, in New York City subway, turnstile hopping, you know, decriminalization, complete decriminalization of marijuana, that there are associations between these crimes and bigger crimes.
All right. Well, thank you, Bill. Thank you, Alicia. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.